This new era, with God's assistance, we begin. The Muslim American Media Alliance presents Meet the Members. The Muslim American Media Alliance members are professionals, organizations, and businesses in the media industry with a collective mission to share information and network. And now, your host, William Kareem.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. And welcome to another edition of Meet the Members. Yes, the Muslim American Media Alliance was founded to organize Muslim media outlets, and MAMA is composed of newspapers, magazines, websites, blogs, radio, television, social, and email networking groups. For as you know, we are living in a time when the news is no longer just black and white. It is now colored with particular opinion of pundits, politicians, and news organizations. Many times, Al-Islam and Muslim Americans have been ostracized and misrepresented without having an opportunity to respond or be considered. The Muslim American Media Alliance has come together to cover the news opinions and events of the day and to share our unique point of view with America and the rest of the world, and also to provide a platform for the artists and the professionals that are involved in it. And today, we have such a professional, my brother, Ron Foster Sharif. Assalamu alaikum, brother Ron. How are you today, brother? Okay, there we go. Ron, you on. How are you?
Yes, wa alaikum, assalam, brother. I'm doing just fine by the grace of Allah.
Great, great. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to know that I've had the opportunity of meeting Ron Foster Sharif at the one of the Muslim conventions that took place in Chicago. We had an opportunity to sit down and talk. Brother Ron, could you give our listeners just a little history about, you know, your growth and development, how you became a Muslim, and how you actually got involved in the religion of Al-Islam?
Well, I actually stood up and accepted what I heard to be the truth when I was 12 years old under the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I formally moved into the Nation of Islam when I was 18 years old. So I came through that first experience back in 1969, in the late 60s, and in that era on through up until the transition to 1975. I guess around 1976 or 1977, I sort of stepped away from the community for a while based on some things I didn't quite understand at the time. And I was one of those members who stepped away and went the same direction with Minister Farrakhan. And I sort of stayed with Minister Farrakhan for a while and then just started to drift back into the community, doing some activist work and doing some medical research for a pharmaceutical company, Eli Lilly and Company, doing some biochemistry research. And
very well-known company, yes.
And sort of did that for 30 years. But I moved back to Imam Muhammad's community around 1994. And I've sort of been with him and with his tafsir in his language ever since.
Very good. Now, I think that one of the important questions that I should ask, culturally speaking, because I think that coming from, because you come from a Christian background, as most of us do in America, is that correct?
Yes, yes, I did.
Yeah.
Catholic.
Yeah.
I was, went to Catholic school.
Yeah, coming from the Christian background and embracing the teachings of the Honorable Master Elijah Muhammad, I think I would like to ask you, how did that play on your educational development? Did you quit school? Did you have a hard time in school? Did you, after high school, especially you're talking about 12 years old, did you continue into college? What did you do? How did that play out?
Well, I've always been somewhat fortunate when it came to my academic studies. I've always, coming through high school, I was very politically active. I was a member of the Black Panther Party coming through high school. In fact, I had been appointed by the Black Panther Party as a minister of information on the high school level. Coming through high school, I did that. I also participated in the Golden Gloves, I boxed for the state championship of Indiana, and was very active that way while I was involved with the Black Panther Party. I always had a knack and a love for my academics in spite of some of the other things that I was doing. So I sort of went right from high school right on into college and sort of stayed in college studied chemistry and as a major and biology as a minor. And once I was employed at Eli Lilly's doing research, I was also trained in scientific photography by the company. And when I got close to the end of my 30-year career, that's when I decided to make a game plan for my retirement. So 10 years out, I went back to school, back to Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis, and enrolled in a photography curriculum and graduated from that also. So I've never really had any problem with my academic career based on what I understood and accepted as far as my religion and its dean is concerned.
You know, that's very interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, in the listening audience, I have always known Ron Foster Sharif as a photographer and video journalist. And over the years, I've seen him develop. He's just exposed more of himself as far as his photojournalism is concerned. But he just made an interesting statement to me. And it's how he transitioned into his educational career from chemistry as a major working with Eli Lilly to scientific photography. That sounds very, very interesting, Brother Ron. What can you tell us about scientific photography that made you interested to continue in its vein?
Well, actually, I grew up, I owe my love of photography to my uncle, who raised me. He was very involved in photography, even to the point that he had his own dark room, and I used to see these pictures hanging up drying and all that sort of stuff. So it was sort of a natural progression when I got to Eli Lilly's and started doing work, doing scientific research and different areas of therapy, looking for a drug and, you know, then looking for a disease or looking for a disease, taking the disease model and looking for a drug. I got into doing some recombinant DNA and got into cloning and doing some cloning work for them. And as you pursue drug therapies, against different disease models, you know, this work has to be documented. You have to have photography when you're looking at the reaction of different side chains and how they react when you add other side chains to the experiment, when you set up the experiments. All that has to be documented. The movement of DNA, the movement of different cancer cells in different types of biological systems and different kind of experimentation. All that has to be documented by photography in research, and it was in that capacity that I got into scientific photography, and the company saw that what they felt that I had a talent and a niche for it. So they provided, first off, a great deal of in-house training. They would bring in specialists from all over the country. When different programs came online, like Photoshop and when digital became a new medium, then I was singled out and sent off to different classes and different facilities around the state to spend sometimes as long as 6 months just learning different aspects of scientific photography. Some of my best work I wasn't able to bring with me because of the proprietary nature, but of research. A lot of people don't realize that in biological systems, even with something as deadly as cancer, that the growth of cancer cells has a certain symmetry and beauty to them. And that's true in a lot of different biological systems. And I was published in three international journals for my scientific work at the bench, in the lab, doing experimentation. And I also was published in several scientific journals as far as the images that I took of different experiments in different biological systems.
So I just want to make sure that I understand and our audience understands some of the more complicated things that you're actually talking about, is that when you're doing biological research and especially recording these images that various diseases and cells can take on different dimensions as far as the image is concerned, which gives you information to go on. Is that correct?
Yes, and to make make decisions. As you well know, the scientific method is moving from the known to the unknown. Well, and then from once the unknown becomes known, then you move again from the known to the unknown. And when you do this in research, you make decisions based on the data at hand. Well, that data has to be documented not only in a notebook and in equations and that sort of thing, but you also have to use photography to actually document the work that you're doing, and also use photography to accompany the publication of your work in international medical journals around the world. So, photography.
So a lot of this information is shared. It's a universal sharing that goes on as far as medical technology and information. Is that correct?
That is exactly correct. Yes, sir, it is.
Now, you know, this is, you know, we haven't, ladies and gentlemen, I just want you to know that we're talking to Ron Foster-Sharif. He is a video and photo journalist now, but we're talking about some of his education and experience as far as developing himself. But, Ron, I think that because this is the Muslim American Media Alliance, I don't think I can get away without asking you the more spiritual side of the question that many who probably believe in God, how did your religious experience and understanding play into your development as a scientific photographer?
Well, one of the things that has always stuck with me was the story that we were told in the Nation of Islam in our lessons about the scientist Shabazz, and how Shabazz went down into the jungles of Africa and created a people close to the earth. That type of story, the other story we were told about the scientist Yaqub, and what the myth said that he done, which was actually manipulating recombinant DNA in order to create a people, that myth, all those type of things served as inspiration to me in my development as a scientist when I was doing that type of work, when I had to stand in front of some of the major scientists in the Western world that would come, and I had to do presentations of my work in front of them, and I'd have all of them in the room, and these type of presentations tend to turn into a shootout at the OK Corral. They got in a lot of cases to be very, very vicious with, you know, scientists attacking in these meetings your work, your data, your techniques. So when I was in those type of situations, I sort of channeled, in order for me to get through them, I sort of channeled back to those teachings of and envisioned in my mind of how Dr. Shabazz would talk if he had to, you know, talk in front of these people, how the scientist Yaqub would talk if he had to talk in front of these people. And in that way, and in that sense, it served to help me. And then as I grew in my deen and I began to understand and read the Holy Quran and begin to see some of the strengths and details that the Holy Quran would go into that would show light on different elements of science, and realize that the even though the Holy Quran is not a book of science, you know, it's a book of revelation, but nonetheless, it sheds a lot of light on the whole idea of science, and it teaches you to read creation, and that's all scientists that are successful. That's all they really do is read creation. So as I move further and further into a proper Islam under the language of Imam Muhammad and begin to explore and go deeper into the Holy Quran, then it really just sort of just, you know, my growth took on an exponential kind of growth, because I began to read creation a little bit differently than I had before I went into the Holy Quran. So in that sense, it's all about in the Holy Quran. I mean, it's just a incredible book.
Very beautiful, very beautiful. We're talking with Ron Foster Sharif, a video and photo journalist, and we're talking historically about his development, and some of this information and is fascinating, really. I find it very fascinating, Brother Ron. Sometimes that's why I'm saying that that's why we say that it's very important for us as the Muslim American Media Alliance to have this kind of conversation on Meet the Members, so that people can understand that when they see the face Ron Foster Sharif or any of our other members, that there is much more to them than just that face on the page. And we are really thankful that you are taking the time to help us to fill out the circle to get a better understanding of how you have developed into the photojournalist and photographer that you are today. So now we've talked about some of your education and your political activism in college, and let me ask you this, because there are people that are going to be listening to this broadcast that will face challenges as far as developing as an artist in college. What is it that, what was the stick-to-itiveness that kept you in school? Was it just was college challenging? Was the social aspects of college? How did you address the social aspects of college along with the where their pressures from the staff of the college as far as your teachers are concerned, especially you being Black Panther and having some ideas that may have gone contrary to some of the ideas as far as your studies is concerned. How were you able to overcome and have that stick-to-itiveness as far as college was concerned, culture and intellectually speaking?
Well, I think Allah blessed me early on as a child to develop a love for academics to the point that I see it in one of my children at least who excels academically, who's now in grad school working on an MBA, but he was always able to move among his peers and not be a victim of peer pressure and, you know, of being afraid to carry books home and that sort of thing. And that's the way that I was. I just had an early love. When I first wrote up on biology and science, I knew that's where I needed to be. So I just sort of enjoyed that from early on, and it was sort of the love that I had for science and especially biology that just made me disregard and ignore the peer pressure that I would face when I would walk to the library and there were my partners were hanging on the corner. Well, I'm not going to say that I didn't hang on the corners, too, but I would hang on the corners after I would, you know, finish what I had to do at the library.
There you go.
And that's the way I rode. That's just the way that I rode. So.
But what about the intellectual establishment that was actually giving you that information? How was you able your perception of them as teachers and mentors, how were you able to accept what they were trying to give you and also be a Black Panther at the same time?
That was very problematic, extremely problematic, and it became more problematic when I got into college, and there was a point that I almost flunked out of college after I read Dr. Ben Yohakinen's book, Black Man on the Nile, and then I had also read extensively A Message to the Black Man and those type of books. And, you know, I had one understanding as far as history and a separate understanding as far as what I was being told, and I was having a lot of conflict with my professors because, you know, I would write a paper one way based on all these other authors, Dr. James, all the great historians that, you know, put out the African-centered books. And it made me reflect on what W.E.B. Du Bois said, that in the soul of when he talked, I forget the name of the book, but he talked about the American Negro having a certain degree of schizophrenia in order to deal with this two separate people that are within us. And it was at that point that I realized that I had to cultivate this healthy dose of schizophrenia. I had to have two people rolling inside of me. I had to have one person that would continue to study our great African Americans and African historians and study what they're publishing, and I also have to have a separate person to study and incorporate and internalize what the universities are putting out there, because it doesn't matter what Dr. Ben or Chancellor Williams John Henry Clark is saying, any of those great scholars, or Sheikh Anta Diop, what matters in order to get through that class is you have to regurgitate what that professor in front of you is saying. And once I understood that and separated myself from doing otherwise and being so confrontational about it and just, you know, rolling as two mentalities, then I started to make progress in my academic. But it was still quite problematic. But I mean, because there was some things that we were being taught in the Nation of Islam that, you know, if you are serious as a scientist, I mean, you can't hang on to them things about, you know, how the moon was created, you know, that theology that we were teaching, so yeah. That we were taught. You can't hang on to those things. And yet you had another side of you that were hanging on to them because of your love for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. May peace and blessings be upon him. And may Allah forgive him all his sins and grant him paradise. And what Master Farad taught. And may Allah bless Master Farad with mercy and forgiveness for all his sins and bless him with paradise. So, you know, you had to develop and split yourself in two, like W.D. Bois, what he said, and then move forward.
Yeah, the name of that book was Souls of Black Folks.
Souls of Black Folks, right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Well, we are almost halfway through the program, and this is, you know, I'm really glad, Ron, that you're on with us because, brother, you're really dropping it. And I think it's important for our members, but I'm hoping that there'll be many that'll listen to this because there's a lot to learn from some of the things that you're talking about as far as growth and development is concerned. Now let's transition. Let's transition into how you started to develop as a media journalist. And what I really would like to ask you is your relationship with the Muslim Journal, because that's how I met you as a photojournalist for the Muslim Journal. Can you tell us about that relationship?
Well, I'm a contributing photojournalist for the Muslim Journal. I've enjoyed moving around the country doing that type of work. I've enjoyed working with a sister editor and with some of the other staff members at the Muslim Journal. And it also allowed me to gain access to other options and other venues where I can do some work, including with the immigrant community. I've done a lot of work for them also. I was at one time the official photographer for MANA. Under, as you know, MANA is under the umbrella of Siraj Wajah and his community.
Good brother. Good brother.
Good brother. Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Very very scholarly, him and Abdur Rashid and Dr. Sherman Jackson. And I was able to move among all three communities based on my relationship that I developed with the Muslim Journal. And the Muslim Journal gave me a lot of freedom to be in the experiment as an artist and to learn to move forward as an artist. It was very, very difficult initially because, as you know, coming out of a scientific research background, then the work that you're doing in that sense is left brain. And left brain controls the right side of your body, and the right side of your brain controls the left side of your body. And the left side of the brain is what is the mathematical side that deals with that type of stuff, And the right side of the brain is where your creativity lies. So
yes.
I had to learn to start using my right brain in order to be more creative and artistic. And the Muslim Journal allowed me, they were very, very patient with some of my early images that were just pretty pictures, but they really didn't tell the story. A good journalistic picture not just has to be technically correct as far as your exposures and that sort of thing, but in technique-wise, but the picture itself has to tell a story. And that's why...
Can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because, and I'm saying that, as again, for information to our audience, because you know that today we have a plethora of ability to take photography. So, you know, I mean, there's cameras all over the place on your phone, camcorders. I mean, you can get a $2 camera and really, you know, just what is the idea when you say actually taking, what are the ideas and techniques for taking a picture?
Well, there's a standard teaching in photography, especially in photojournalism, that they call the rule of the third. And in that sense, when you're looking through the eyepiece of a camera and you take an image, you generate an image, capture an image, then when you pull that image up and look at it, then it should have three areas of focus where your eye goes to in that image. And first of all, in order for the image to have any type of real meaning to it. Well, of course, first you have to make sure that you are technically correct. You have to make sure that your exposures are correct. You have to make sure your white balance in the picture is correct. You have to pay attention to all these different type of details. Then you move to where you look at the rule of the thirds, and your eye has to an ideal picture, your eye has to go to three places in that image as a focus. Then as you move from that, then you have to take the three different areas of focus. They all have to, two areas should generate a point your vision or the viewer's image focus to the one element that tells the story that the picture is about. I remember one time when I was in the Caribbean, and I stopped in an island. I forget which island it was. It may have been Antigua or Virgin. I forget which one it was, but I remember hiring a taxi driver and paying him to drive me all over the island, and I was just popping pictures, man, just popping pictures. And when I got back to the States and I looked at all the pictures, well, I mean, all I had was a bunch of pretty pictures. And I was very, very disappointed in that. When other people would look at the pictures, they would talk about how beautiful they were and how, you know, how they liked the pictures, but the pictures didn't tell a story of the island. It didn't tell a story of the people. And it's it was at that point that I realized the validity of when you take a picture, just don't take the picture without thinking about what you're looking at through that viewfinder before you push the shutter button. And I do that now. I do a lot more thinking before I push that shutter button than I used to, and I, you know, would hope that Allah blesses me to become even more cerebral before I push the shutter button, because that's very important, especially when you look at some of our masters like Gordon Parks. When you look at some of his work, he was just an incredible photographer. John White, who shot for the different Chicago publications, some of his work. And then there's Andre Cartier-Bresson. When you look at some of his work and the pictures, sometimes they don't even need a caption. You look at the picture, and the picture just speaks to you. That's the type of photography that that I've tried to transcend it. I tried to transcend into, and some of that came out on my recent trips to Africa and in the, to Cuba. I was a lot more happy with the way that those images looked when I got back than I was with that initial trip to that island in the Caribbean. So your picture really has to just tell a story. I see a lot of people that will just raise up a camera and just start busting off frames, And I'm like, what are you taking a picture of? Why are you taking the picture? You really have to go through a checklist like a good quarterback. You really have to kind of go through a checklist of different progressions and ask yourself, why am I taking this picture? What am I trying to show in this picture? What's in the picture? Why am I allowing that in the picture? You have to do your cropping in the camera instead of waiting until you get back at the computer and start trying to crop out stuff. You have to do your cropping in the camera before you take the shot. So I was happy with my progression to that, and the Muslim Journal was very, very patient and allowed me to develop to the point that they were, you know, very, very pleased with the work that I was and have been producing.
Very well said, very well said. And, you know, thanks for sharing that rule of the third. And it definitely takes us to the other point. You know, we're past halfway through the program, and I don't know if we actually scheduled enough time, but I did want to ask you about some of the work that I've seen that you've done in other countries. Can you tell us some of the countries that you've gone to do shooting, and were these for assignments or for your own creative, your own looking to tell the story, as you say? Did you go to these other countries on assignment or just looking to tell the story, looking for a story to tell?
Basically it was both. I've been to Egypt, and that was a documentary that I wanted to shoot that I call A Journey Through the Through the Books of Stone, where I came into Egypt at Cairo, and I went into the desert and went into all the ancient and holy places that were holy to us as Africans, and went all the way down to the border of Sudan, and went in all the different pyramids, went into all the different temple complexes, went into areas where a lot of the public were not allowed to go. I was traveling with a group of scholars who could actually read the Medinetter that was on the raw wall. Medinetter is the Africans' name for what the Greeks called hieroglyphics. And so I was able to document a lot of that work and understand some of the messages that our ancient ancestors left on the wall for us. And I was actually able to see some of the ancient things that our ancestors dealt with that is incorporated into our deen today. Like I saw 5,000 and 6,000 year old images carved into the wall of our ancient ancestors doing Salat, of our ancient ancestors using the word that to now is called Hajj, one of the things that really impressed me that I saw was when the sun comes up. At dawn, in Africa, the baboon actually will turn to the east and will actually put his hand up behind his ears and call out like he's calling the Adon, and will actually bow to the sun like we do when we're at Fajr prayer.
Yes.
And it so impressed the Africans that they built a whole temple devoted to this observation that they saw of the baboon making salat. So you see those type of things. You see those type of things, and it enhances your understanding of your deen.
And appreciation.
I then went to Ethiopia. I was in Ethiopia for almost a month, and I was able to see the different aspects of African Christianity, and to document that, and to actually be in the presence of the original painting of the Black Madonna and Child, and to have access of a Bible that predates the King James Version of the Bible, a Bible that's just hundreds and hundreds of years old, and to actually visit the masjid that the Sahabas, when they and their families, when they went into Ethiopia, to escape the persecution, and where they were at in Ethiopia, and the masjid that they built in Ethiopia, under the the name of the Negus that actually provided the protection to the early Muslims. But I was able to do that. I don't think there's hardly a country, with the exception, believe it or not, of Bermuda. There's not hardly a country in the Caribbean that I haven't been to. And I think my most memorable experience was when I had the opportunity to shoot in Cuba. I was in Cuba for almost a month, and I shot in Cuba. I was shooting the hip hop community in Cuba.
Really?
Yes, yes, and that was an incredible experience.
When was that, Ron?
I was in Cuba around 2006.
Okay.
And I was able to move among the hip hop community in Cuba, and actually generate some images of the house where the at first it was underground, where hip hop first came into Cuba, and the repression and the persecution that the young hip hoppers experienced under Fidel Castro and his regime, until they realized the political capital that was available to them if they could control hip hop.
Right.
And hip hop in outside of the United States is viewed differently, where at least it was historically, is viewed differently than the hip hop that young people listen to inside the United States. It has more social content to it.
Yes.
At least it did.
Okay. It doesn't anymore, as much as it did.
It's starting to be affected in a negative way also.
So it was more culture conscious, more political consciousness in it,
yes.
As opposed to, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Then, but not now. Like, I spoke to one of the producers in Havana that told me when he was recording this particular young hip hopper, that the guy kept, when he would rap, he would rap about his guns and his big pretty cars, right? And the producer had to tell him, look, man, you don't have a gun and you don't even have a car. What are you rapping? But he was being influenced.
Yeah, that's the
being influenced by the hip hop that he was hearing in the States. And I want to bring this point out also, that was so mind-blowing about hip-hop community in Cuba. I met this guy with these long dreadlocks. His name was Dr. Drela, right? And he was a rapper. And he's a very, very popular rapper in Cuba. Well, it turns out that he is a medical doctor, and he has a full practice during the day, and he's a rapper by night. and he's more popular as a rapper than he is as a medical doctor, and he certainly makes more money. So it was those type of images that I saw while I was in Cuba, not to even mention the ceremony that they took the African American males through when we were in Cuba, that they at a rumba festival where they said that they were gonna put back into us through the ceremony, they were gonna put back into us something that was taken out of us during slavery. And it certainly did something, so it was really quite an experience. Have all these people surrounding you doing this type of laying of hands on type of ceremony, and watching, looking at, you know, your fellow travelers, other brothers, African American brothers, and we're all crying because something spiritual was actually happening to us. It was very, very real. And
yes.
And the different attitudes that we had when we came back to the States, and we had to come back through customs, and the Homeland Security was there waiting on us, going through our baggage, and the FBI, and they were questioning us. We had a different response and a different state of mind when we were in front of all these powerful groups, what the rappers called Alphabet Boys, because all the different Alphabet Boys were there when we came back through customs. And I'm talking about Homeland Security,
et cetera.
Everybody questioning us. And this time when we came through after this ceremony, I mean, there was absolutely no fear, man. I mean, our blood pressure, at least for me, our blood pressure didn't even go up when, we stood there and presented all our documentation about why we was in Cuba and to let know that not only was I in Cuba, but I planned to go back to finish my work. Cuba is a wonderful, wonderful place.
You know, Ron, within the last couple of minutes that we have, I did have some other questions that I really wanted to talk to you about, but I think what we're going to have to do is, what I want to do is just ask you, what are you doing today? What is Capture Images, Imaging and Media Services all about, and what else are you involved in today?
Well, as you know, earlier in the year, I was afforded the opportunity to shoot the events leading up to the Super Bowl. I shot quite a few events 2 weeks before the Super Bowl and was also able to shoot in the Super Bowl, shoot the game itself. And out of that came some other opportunities. I've been shooting for two publications from London, England, and my work is getting a lot of exposure in Europe, especially during the recent presidential elections. I was able to do a lot of traveling in the Midwest with the Ryan and Romney ticket. And actually document some of his what they were doing, and have my work published not only in Europe, but also had another publication that was based in Los Angeles. So I'm getting a lot more exposure, as well as having a lot of my work published on a regular basis by a local black newspaper that publishes throughout the state of Indiana, one of the oldest black weeklies in the country, in fact, and has a circulation base here. And also to continue to have my work done shown and showcased in the Muslim Journal. I have some projects on the trestle board right now that this time that will take me back to Africa and to South America. I was in South America back in June doing some work, and this particular set of projects that I'm working on now will carry me through maybe 10 different African countries and then move into South America. I'm sort of working on a project that is the reverse of that program, Who Do You Think You Are, where, you know, individuals
yeah.
trace their roots back to Africa. Well, this
yeah.
is starting in Africa and following our roots from Africa through from the Nile Valley to the west coast of Africa, and from the west coast to where we got on slave ships to South America, then up through the Caribbean, then to the cotton fields of Mississippi and Alabama, and document all of that. I'm working on that project, and I have another project that I'm working on to sort of show the strange relationship that African people and people in general, but especially African people, have with sugar. So that's going to involve me spending a lot of time in the sugarcane fields down in Brazil, and following that up through the sugarcane fields in the Caribbean and into southern Florida in that area, and sort of creating a documentary to show this relationship from cultivating sugar and being forced to be enslaved in order to cultivate it and chop it and grow it, and now we're suffering from, you know, just epidemic rates of sugar diabetes. So
Well, let me ask you, Ron, because you did mention, you know, right after this program, we're continuing with an interview of the film that has that is here in America right now called Othello Burning, and the producer director Sarah Bleacher is going to be our guest in the next hour. And Ron, just to let you know that she produced and directed the South African version of Who Do You Think You Are. Do you know her?
No, I don't.
Oh, man, that was just fascinating, man, that you would mention Who Do You Think You Are, man. You know, that's really something. So this is a continuation. This Who Do You Think You Are, the one that you're going to be working on, is something that's being continued, that's coming up in the future?
Yes, yes. And in fact, the whole South Africa idea is very, very important to the project, because it follows the migration of Bantu languages as they moved away from the Nile Valley. And one of the migration patterns that they went to is that they went south down through Ethiopia and Sudan and moved into South Africa. So I'm really, really looking forward to that. And it's strange that you said, I just generated some coverage, I guess about 3 weeks ago, of Reverend Alan Bosack, who's a visiting professor here in Indianapolis. I had an opportunity to generate some coverage and spend some time with him. And I was fascinated with why South Africa evolved the way that it has since Mandela came out of jail, and why I was also curious about why they chose the truth and reconciliation model as opposed to the Nuremberg model that happened in Germany after World War II. So, yeah, South Africa is very important on my list of places to get to, and it's very it plays a very significant role in my upcoming documentary, inshallah.
Well, Ron, I thank you so very much for taking the time to be with us on the radio program Meet the Mama Members. You definitely dropped it today, brother. And we appreciate it so very much. And ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters that's going to be listening to this, Ron Foster Sharif is a video journalist and photographer and a member of the Muslim American Media Alliance. He's very active. He's been very supportive of myself and Touré Muhammad and the efforts that the Muslim American Media Alliance is making here in the United States of America. And Brother Ron, we appreciate you so very much. Thank you so very much for taking the time.
Thank you, brother, for having me, and may Allah continue to bless you and your whole staff with continued success.
Thank you, brother. Assalamu alaikum, rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.